This show is sponsored by Liquid IV. Here's an obvious statement. Being dehydrated is not fun. There have been times when I've had marathon podcast sessions to get through, where I've had to be on for long stretches, and being dehydrated during those times is brutal. My head starts pounding, I can't focus as much as I need to. Again, not fun. But here's another statement that I hope is obvious to you by now. Long days require top-notch hydration from start to finish, and just one stick of Liquid IV sugar-free and 16 ounces of water is clinically demonstrated to hydrate faster than water alone. Right now, you can get 20% off your first order with code FILMWEEKLY at checkout. Liquid IV's clinically tested formula is designed to optimize water absorption and hydration, and it's backed by a scientific advisory board. If you're looking to stay hydrated and present during busy days, if you're taking a big flight, or maybe you feel run down after a long night out, give it a shot. I personally recommend the Mandarin Orange sugar-free flavor, which is very light and refreshing, but all the flavors contain 8 essential vitamins and nutrients. I just had some right before recording this, and if I had it during those marathon sessions, I'm sure I would have felt way better. Rehydrate with science-backed hydration from Liquid IV's Hydration Multiplier Sugar-Free. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code FILMWEEKLY at checkout. That's 20% off your first order with code FILMWEEKLY at liquidiv.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Weekly. It's Wednesday, April 1st, 2026. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. We'll take a little diversion into Jacob's Trailer Park. We'll talk about They Will Kill You and present interviews with the director, producers, and cast of that movie. And then I'll talk a bit about Mike and Nick and Nick and Alice and present an interview with writer-director Ben David Grabinski. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com. And let's kick things off with a few casting stories. A report came out last week that Ryan Gosling is going to be teaming up with Daniels to star in their next movie, which will be the first film they'll direct since Everything Everywhere All at Once. Nobody knows what that's about or even what genre it's supposed to be in, but that is supposed to start shooting this summer. So I'm very excited about that collaboration. Adam Sandler has a new Netflix movie lined up, but this one does not sound like one of his goofball comedies. It's called Time Out, and it's a remake of a French film that I will not try to butcher the pronunciation here, but it's about a guy who is fired from his job, but he can't bring himself to tell his family about it. So instead, he spins a web of elaborate lies to hide the truth, and things end up escalating when he cooks up an investment scheme and asks his friends to contribute to it. Sandler is starring in this, and it has a pretty solid supporting cast, including Gabby Hoffman, Willem Dafoe, Steve Zahn, and F. Murray Abraham. Scott Cooper, who most recently wrote and directed Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, and The Pale Blue Eye before that, is writing and directing this movie. I'm mixed to negative about him as a filmmaker, so I don't have a ton of faith in this one at this stage, but you never know. I'm always hoping to be surprised. We've known for a little while that Daniel Deadwyler is going to be starring in the new version of The X-Files that Ryan Coogler is overseeing. He is writing and directing the pilot, and I think he's going to be on board as an executive producer after that. But now we know that Himesh Patel will be co-starring as the other FBI agent alongside Deadwyler, which is pretty cool. I like both of them as actors, and the two of them actually worked together on the Station 11 TV show several years ago, so should be a nice reunion for them. Grammy-winning pop star Dua Lipa is going to star alongside Molly Gordon and Ali Levitan in a new movie for A24 called Peaked, which follows, quote, the two girls who traumatized you in high school as they try to relive their glory days at their 10-year reunion. Molly Gordon, who you might know as Claire from The Bear, is directing this movie, and she's writing the script with Ali Levitan. Emma Mackey, Connor Story, and Laura Dern are among the supporting cast members here, so I hope this ends up being fun. Next up, the Lonely Island member Andy Samberg is going to be starring in a new film called 42.6 Years at Focus Features. It's a rom-com that follows a guy who is cryogenically frozen for 42.6 years and then sets out to reconnect with his ex-girlfriend, who is now played by Annette Bening. He has not aged a day, but she has obviously lived like her whole life without him, basically. So Samberg cooked up the story for this with a guy named Seth Reese, who wrote The Menu and A Big, Bold, Beautiful Journey. And Seth wrote this script. Michael Schwartz is going to be directing this. I'm not super familiar with his work. And this project as a whole, even though I like some of the people involved, sounds like it could kind of go either way. So wait and see mode on this one. Let's move to a couple pieces of release date news. The Housemaid 2 is supposed to be coming out on December 17th, 2027, which is 2 years after the original. Right now, that's the same date as Avengers Secret Wars and Lord of the Rings The Hunt for Gollum, which sounds like just a super busy stretch heading into the end of next year. So brace yourselves in advance, I guess. And Animal Friends, which The Hollywood Reporter describes as a live-action hybrid. A hybrid with what? They don't say. I don't know. Has been bumped from fall 2025 to summer 2026 and has now moved to January 22nd, 2027. Ryan Reynolds, Aubrey Plaza, Jason Momoa, Dan Levy, and a few other people are in this, but a January release date like that is not a great time to release a movie historically, so we'll see how that plays out. And finally, we'll round things out with two pieces of sequel news. Lights Out was a horror movie that came out 10 years ago, and it's now getting a sequel because New Line has hired an up-and-coming writer named Connor Osborne McIntyre to write the script for a follow-up. David F. Sandberg, who made his feature directorial debut with the first movie, will be one of the producers of the sequel. We don't know what the second one will be about exactly, but the first one was made for less than $5 million and ended up grossing almost $150 million worldwide. So I'm frankly surprised they haven't made a sequel sooner. And then after the huge financial success of Scream 7 so far, it was only a matter of time, but now we know that Scream 8 is indeed in the works because Lilla and Nora Zuckerman have been hired to write the script for that. They previously served as the showrunners of Poker Face Season 1, and they worked as writers on shows like Fringe, Suits, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and a couple others. Most recently, they wrote the pilot for that Buffy the Vampire Slayer continuation that Hulu ended up passing on. So Scream 8 sounds like a pretty decent rebound gig for them. Okay, that's all the news I have for you for now. So let's take a quick break, and then we'll get into the rest of the show. I'm joined now by Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello. If you hear anything in the background, my cats, Benj, they're literally wrestling. We're not wrestling as of 10 seconds ago, so apologies for any feline, like, hissing, growling you may hear on your end.
I very much welcome all animal noises on this podcast. I also welcome you to the podcast, Jacob. It's been a little while since we've done a Jacob's Trailer Park segment, and so that means we have a lot of trailers to get through. I'm going to kind of clear out and just let you cook for the most part on this. So let's begin this exercise. What did you think about the trailer for Spider-Man Brand New Day?
All right. I'm at a point with my Marvel fandom where I'm a bit jaded. I'm a bit, you know, over it. I need a break. I've taken a break from superhero comics, at least modern superhero comics, and I can't bring myself to get excited for Avengers Doomsday, despite, you know, all the things involved there. So I feel like a big old dumb dummy for watching Spider-Man Brand New Day trailer and be like, yeah, this is what I want right now. I've been missing this flavor of Spider-Man, which is the stressed out Spider-Man living in a crappy apartment, trying to do his best, where every single part of his day is full of villains and mayhem and chaos. I think this movie is so risked. It's such a big risk here for being overstuffed and too much going on. So I really hope the goal here is less of too many moving plot points and more of a simulation of Peter Parker having the toughest life in all of superhero comics. So I don't know, Ben. I watched this trailer and I said, yes, I really want more Tom Holland Spider-Man, and I'm mad at myself for wanting it as much as I do. So 7.5 out of 10 for this trailer. It worked for me. It pushed my buttons. And I'm pretty excited for it.
Okay. What about Dune Part 3?
Oh, okay. There's no guilt involved in loving this trailer. This is one hell of a piece of marketing. I'm an on-the-record Dune super fan. Those first two movies are straight up some of my all-time favorites, and I think Dune Messiah is such a strange book, and such a as a trilogy capper for Denis Villeneuve is going to be such a big challenge. And I think this trailer does a good job of selling how they're going to adapt it, which is all the things that are off screen in the book are being brought to the screen for the movie, which is a pretty bold choice considering what that book chooses to not show. This thing is a dark trailer. The soundtrack, the Fremen chanting over it, is like such a bold move. Everyone's cooking in this trailer. This is a 9 out of 10 trailer I've ever seen one. Ben, Dune 3 feels like the event this year. It's hard to imagine any movie feeling like a bigger deal than Dune 3 to me.
I think, yeah, for you and me and people like us, I think that's the case. I wonder if audiences are going to care as much. The second movie did better than the first movie, so it seems like the fandom is increasing, which is awesome, and it definitely seems like Warner Brothers spared no expense with this movie, which is also awesome. So I really hope that it lives up to the promise of this first teaser. So let's get into Wild Horse 9, which is the new movie from Martin McDonagh. What'd you think about this one?
Yeah, love Martin McDonagh. I even like the ones that are not cool alike. I think Three Billboards is great, and I think the internet did its best to sabotage a complex movie. But I like how McDonagh tends to rotate between his two modes, which is extremely sad Irish people and extremely violent, you know, crime stories, essentially. In this case, we have the latter, which is Sam Rockwell and John Malkovich playing CIA hitmen on a mission. Sort of, this feels like the American in Bruges, all the way down to the characters being on some kind of vacation or simulated vacation as part of a job. I'm still a sucker for McDonagh. He, of all the post Tarantino tough guy, rapid fire back and forth screenwriters to emerge over the past 30 years, he's the best by a long shot. That's because he spends half his time not doing that type of movie. It only returns to it every so often. I think Banshees of Inisherin, his previous movie, is probably his best movie. Not my favorite of his, but the best. So this feels like a bit of a victory lap for him. Kind of like he had his big, giant drama that was bleak and upsetting and also very funny. And I was like, okay, now time for a lark again. Let's have Sam Rockwell and John Malkovich yell at each other and swear at each other for 2 hours. 7.5 out of 10. Really like this trailer. Really excited for more Martin McDonagh. Like I said, it seems a bit more familiar compared to Banshees of Inisherin, but that's not a bad thing. I'm an In Bruges super fan. Bring it on, I say.
Okay. And then let's go to the trailer for Toy Story 5. I think Pixar has released a couple different pieces of marketing for this, but the most recent one as of this recording is like the full trailer for this. So what'd you think about this one?
I mean, it looks good. I mean, there's a level of quality with the Toy Story movies that's pretty consistent. I think Pixar knows that this is their flagship series. These are their flagship characters. That this world matters to people in a way that not every Pixar, series does. I mean, it's what launched the company, literally. And I do think that Andrew Stanton being the director here is a pretty big deal, getting him back in that seat after, him being such a seminal figure for so much of Pixar's growth over the years. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I should be tired of my Toy Story. I feel like I really should be ready to say goodbye to his characters, especially after 3 gave them a conclusion and 4 gave them another conclusion. But it turns out, no, I don't mind seeing Buzz and Woody again. And I think the angle here of bringing electronic toys to essentially, screen-based toys to be a new antagonist has potential to deliver some really interesting commentary if it's not too heavy-handed or ham-handed. And if there's one thing I've learned about Pixar and Toy Story, it's never underestimate them when they're dealing with these characters. This trailer reminded me of how much I like these characters. So yeah, give it an 8 out of 10. I this did its job of reminding me, oh yeah, I could groan at the concept of a fifth Toy Story, but once I see it in action, I'm like, oh man, I actually want this.
Okay. So what about the trailer for the new Scary Movie, which annoyingly is just called Scary Movie? It's doing that same trend that, the Halloween movies have done and Scream movies have done in recent years. I guess it's like probably meant to be a commentary on that by just adopting the same title as the original for this, what would you call it? A spoof franchise. But what'd you think about this trailer?
I wasn't fond of either flavor of Scary Movie. But either the Wayans Brothers versions or the I'm blanking on the director who made.
Oh, was it like Seltzer Friedberg? Did they take over at some point? Or
no, it was the Airplane Naked Gun guys.
Abram Zucker.
Some combination of them. We have the internet at our disposal. I'll look this up in a second. But went from being they had two different flavors of parody going on and. Neither of them did it for me back in the day. So I am not a fan of the series, but so I have to judge this trailer as a trailer. And man, I've seen it like 4 times in theaters now, this trailer. And every time I find it less and less funny, I don't mind that there's like jokes that are trying to push buttons. I mind that's lame. I mind that it's like really tired, like grandma on Facebook posting memes about how she doesn't like trans people type mean. So it's like, all right, go to bed. Like, I want his trailer to drink its warm milk and go to bed, Ben. It really feels like boomers took over the Scary Movie franchise. I know everyone's older now. It's I don't know, opening a trailer with a pronouns joke. It's like, Marlon Wayans is a trans kid. What's even going on here? It's not even a good pronouns joke. If you're going to do this, commit and be funny about it. It just feels like they're making a movie for 55-year-old Trump voters. And I don't give a shit, man. I really don't. Do people who want a horror movie parody also want that? I don't know. It'll probably be a huge hit. I don't know what I'm talking about. All I know is this trailer like rubs me the wrong way. For one, just being pretty unfunny all around. And two, definitely catering for the ha-ha, we're not woke crowd. I'm like, come on, guys. What is this
even? Yeah. Yeah, I feel very much the same way. Okay, so what about the teaser for Lanterns, the HBO show that is set in the DC universe?
Mixed feelings. If this was not called Lanterns, if it was called, Sci-Fi Cops, I'd be like, okay, really on board for this. It looks like a really cool show that has that True Detective vibe going on. Kyle Chandler looks awesome as the grizzled, older Green Lantern. Aaron Pierre looks great as John Stewart, the Green Lantern in training. I think this looks like a really, really cool show. I'm just worried it's going to be embarrassed to be a Green Lantern show. I mean, we see one Green Lantern costume not being worn by anybody. And I'm just wondering, are they hiding the outfits for a reason? Is there going to be a big reveal there? I don't know. I feel like the James Gunn DC Universe has been so on the ball of being unafraid to be goofy. Like they restored Superman's red shorts. I mean, so I don't know why this show, which is part of the same universe, could conceivably be afraid of Green Lantern costume. So I'm hoping the show has a good reason for that, and it's not just a we're too cool to be called Green Lanterns. I guess my main concern really is that I think are they so worried about the Ryan Reynolds movie from 2009 or whatever that they are still freaking out about that? I don't know. To me, it feels like, guys, it's been long enough. No one remembers Green Lantern except you and me, Ben. People are ready for a fresh version. So anyway, I'll give the trailer a 7 out of 10 for as a trailer. But it would be like a 9 out of 10 if it had a different title, because it actually is a really good piece of editing here.
Yeah, I mean, the point you bring up about being afraid of the suit, they kind of already should have solved that, theoretically, because Nathan Fillion played a version of Green Lantern in the Superman movie, and, like, he was all over the trailers. It's not like they were hiding him in that. So, like, audiences conceivably have at least, like, have another role model of what that can look like on screen or something, instead of thinking all the way back to the Ryan Reynolds movie. So anyway, yeah, we'll see. I'm curious to know, because like my understanding is that this Lanterns show was developed before James Gunn took over DC, and so it was kind of, it's been like folded into the DC universe, so I wonder if it will feel tonally very different from everything else that Gunn and his partner Peter Safran have sort of birthed on their own. So yeah, a big question mark around that one. What did you make of the trailer for Power Ballad, which is the new movie from John Carney, the guy behind Sing Street and Once?
Very intrigued by this. It's Paul Rudd and Nick Jonas playing a like low rent musician and a pop superstar who somehow meet up and then become at odds over the ownership of a song. And like all of Carney's previous movies, it's built around music. But this trailer is interesting because it, especially the back half, takes a big tonal shift toward a discomfort and a menacing tone that I don't associate with Carney at all. Mm-hmm. I guess you told me this movie about Paul Rudd and Nick Jonas bonding over a song, becoming best friends. Like, oh yeah, that's Carney material, but then becoming like bitter enemies over it. Feels like a big left turn for the guy who made Once in Sing Street. So, give me the trailer, 8 out of 10. It has my attention because this is not what I expected to have a new John Carney movie. In fact, I kept expecting Tim Robinson to pop up in the back half. It went from being sweet to being like uncomfortable in that Tim Robinson way. I kept expecting like Tim Robinson's friendship character to pop up to assist Paul Rudd here. I don't know, Ben. I know you're a Carney fan, right?
I am, yeah. I think his most recent movie, Flora and Son, I was not as crazy about. That one had like... It dipped a little bit into that kind of acidity that you're talking about, but this feels like it really like jumps off the diving board into that pool at the very end of this movie, or at the very end of this trailer, I should say. So I'm really curious to know if he's able to kind of modulate those tones a little bit better than he did in Flora and Son, which like has that kind of like sticky sweet thing. And then also a little bit of like, oh God, like, you know, where you kind of like cringe a little bit here and there. So yeah, it's going to be all in the execution. I think I'm on board with like the concept and the cast and everything, but yeah, I'm really curious about that. Okay. So let's talk about Forgotten Island, which is a new animated movie from DreamWorks. What'd you think about this trailer?
Yeah, this is one of those things where I did not know this was happening. I've been following it all. One, I'm very happy to see a original animated film coming out of DreamWorks. Any studio these days doing a full brand new original idea deserves celebration, not just, you know, a sequel or remake or whatnot. But Forgotten Island, man, I went from not knowing anything about this movie to being one of my most anticipated movies of the year, like instantly from this trailer. Mm-hmm. I watched this trailer and was kind of blown away by the animation style, by the pitch of what the story is about, and by like the very strong assumption this movie's gonna wreck me in a way that a few movies have wrecked me since, you know, the golden age of like Pixar tearjerkers like Up. So this is a 10 out of 10 trailer because it literally did its job of making me go from zero knowledge to opening night I will be there instantly.
Yeah, man, great call. Okay, so we have to address the Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone teaser. As much as I would like to just ignore this altogether, this is one of the biggest trailer launches for HBO in their history, or at least HBO Max in its history. So what did you think about this one?
All right, if we choose to ignore the J.K. Rowling of it all, which is impossible because this show is directly funding her and her, you know, active funding of legislation to harm trans people, which is, we've spoken about it enough, but it always needs to be asterisked and said over and over again. If you buy Harry Potter or support Harry Potter merchandise, you are complicit in that. This still doesn't look very good, Ben. It looks like, what if the original movies had their color palette turned gray and were remade for actors? The sets look the same. Costumes look the same. Most of this art design looks the same because there's so much merchandise that exists already that they can't redo it. So it is a huge mess. It looks expensive. It doesn't look badly made. It just looks completely useless in a way that I don't know why this should exist, other than to make money, other than to use a familiar name to pad pockets of people who only want to rely on franchises and not, you know, the fact that HBO is one of the great creative powerhouses in the industry and now they're wasting time and money on this shit. This is a 2 out of 10 trailer. Fuck J.K. Rowling and fuck this trailer.
Yeah, to me, this is like the pure distillation of a David Zaslav decision. I believe this was a decision that he made, and this just kind of like not thinking about the... or any artistic reasoning behind it and just purely like squeezing IP for IP's sake and then doing it in this style and just being kind of like gleeful about it. And then like now having Warner Brothers probably be sold to Paramount and he walks away with like whatever it is, $800 million or something like that after making a decision like this is just like, that's a very David Zaslav thing based on everything that we know about him. So fuck this show to the end of the earth. Okay, so let's talk about something that I'm much more intrigued by, and I'm curious if you had the same reaction. The End of Oak Street, which is David Robert Mitchell's new movie. What'd you think about this trailer?
Yeah, it's one of those trailers that came out of nowhere. I knew he was making another movie, and I knew it was a J.J. Abrams production, but I did not expect this trailer. This is a really wonderful teaser. It came out of nowhere. Anne Hathaway, Ewan McGregor, real Twilight Zone vibes. That was a big reaction that our team had. It was like, this looks like a big bunch of Twilight Zone episode. Specifically, you know, there's an episode of Twilight Zone where an airplane flies through a time portal, ends up, you know, in the distant prehistoric past. But it's that. But also a Twilight Zone episode where, you know, where there may or not be maybe creatures in suburbia. It just feels like that very Rod Serling thing going on here, which is, you know, my exact cup of tea. So yeah, Neighbor Robert Mitchell, It Follows is one of my favorite horror movies of the past, you know, of the century so far. And him making this sort of big budget, you know, Twilight Zone flavored, you know, a horror action sci-fi movie. It looks so cool. I don't know if it's necessarily a dinosaur movie or if it's a movie that features dinosaurs. I think there's a big difference there. But the final reveal of what's happening on this, you know, location and time displaced street, A+ marketing. You had me at Robert Mitchell, but now you have me opening night. This is like a 9 out of 10 for this trailer.
Awesome. Yeah, this used to go by the name Flowervale Street, and there were rumors. There have been rumors about this movie for years that it was going to feature dinosaurs, and I was wondering if the marketing would continue to try to hide that or put it all out for everybody to see. And I'm really glad they chose the latter option, because I think it would have, that surprise would have been something that, like, people who pay attention to online rumors and movie news and stuff like that would have known. And I'm just really glad that the marketing leaned into that and said, like, yeah, this is what we're doing. We're not hiding the ball at all here. We're just giving you, we're confirming that aspect of it while also still making, like, a really intriguing trailer. So I'm very curious to see how that one plays out. I'm really excited about that. And then the last trailer we're going to talk about is one from A24. It's for a movie called Backrooms, which I feel like you and I talked about when it was first announced, maybe, because it comes from a director who was a big deal, or maybe still remains a big deal, on YouTube, right?
Yeah, Backrooms began as a meme. It was a scary picture, and somebody on 4chan of all places wrote a description about how if you clip through reality, you end up in the Backrooms, which is like the place between worlds, essentially. It became like this sort of shared fiction online, and Kane Parsons, a high school student, started making short films for YouTube exploring the Backrooms as a concept. If you haven't seen his YouTube work, Kane Parsons is extraordinarily talented. His Backroom shorts are fantastic. His other horror series, I'm blanking on its name, Ben. Give me one second to look it up. The Oldest View. It's a 4-part YouTube series called The Oldest View. It's one of the scariest things I've ever seen. Not just as a YouTube short, but as like anything. The Oldest View is terrifying. So the idea that this guy is like representing like this whole new generation of, you know, YouTube filmmakers making features, making that transition. He's 20 years old, Ben. He has an A24 movie starring Chiwetel Ejiofor. He's 24. He's 20 years old. And wow. There's a lot riding here. Like, he's not the first YouTuber, you know, to make the jump to making feature films, but he's certainly one of the youngest and certainly one of the highest profile films of this type, because I don't think a lot of people realize, especially people our age who aren't terminally online, like younger people, like teens, know Backrooms. Like, this has been part of the internet mythology for close to a decade now, I guess, maybe since 2017, 2018. So there are a lot of people like who are now have, you know, late teens, early 20s, who grew up with this like as part of their mythology. Like, this is like the same way we grew up excited about like Marvel and superheroes. The people are excited about Backrooms. So I say all this because I think this represents a real pivot point for Hollywood. Like, Backrooms is the kind of movie I think people keep an eye on this, because like Five Nights at Freddy's, like Minecraft, this is something that represents a genuine passion interest for Gen Z as opposed to millennials. And it may represent like the kind of movie that, and the kind of source of movies that start being made from here on out. So all that said, this is a great trailer. It's really eerie and really creepy. It shows just enough of the concept. It's definitely hiding a lot. If you've seen the Backroom shorts, you know that there's a lot of possibilities here beyond just a seemingly infinite self-generating maze space, you know, hidden beyond our world. This trailer does a good job of hinting at the obsession of it. And the final shot of a character walking through a all too narrow space, I think just tips, this is kind of a tip of the hat at how upsetting this could get. This is a 9 out of 10 trailer for me. This, like, I was already on board for this. I'm already a fan of Parsons. He's probably the youngest person whose work I legitimately enjoy. Ben, where do you stand on this? I'm curious how familiar you are with any of this.
I was not familiar with Kane Parsons. I had no idea about the concept of back rooms. My entry point for this is I read, this was probably a couple years ago now, I read a book called House of Leaves that came out in 2000 by Mark Z. Danielewski. And have you read that book?
Yeah, House of Leaves is frequently mentioned in connection to back rooms. It's not confirmed if the people who started creating the initial back rooms memes knew House of Leaves, but they are definitely connected thematically and like visually.
Yeah, that book, I mean, it's a very complicated thing, but like very basically somebody discovers a room in their house that is, it doesn't make sense like architecturally. The room is much bigger than the space should be. And so they do this kind of like spelunking into this room and explore what the hell is going on. And it's almost like a horror book in that way, because there's just such a creeping dread and like sense of the unknown and everything. And it feels like this movie, while not being associated with House of Leaves in any way, really taps into that feeling, which is my lasting memory of that book. That's a thing that I feel like I'm going to remember the experience of reading that book for the rest of my life, just because maybe I didn't even love the book overall, but that idea was like so strong and so well conveyed in that story. And seeing it brought to the screen, even in a trailer form in back rooms, is like freaking me out in a really good way. So I hope the movie can live up to that.
Yeah, I'm a big House of Leaves fan, and I do think that House of Leaves quietly permeated internet horror. A lot of things that, like, a lot of the horror that grew out of, like, internet culture, in terms of, like, when people on forums, like, backroom stuff, like SCP, which is another internet rabbit hole that could be mined for future films. I think that House of Leaves quietly helped establish a ground base for internet horror in a way that maybe the younger folks who are now playing in that playground may not even be aware, but I think that that book is massively influential on this kind of stuff, whether it gets credit or not.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, we did it, man. This is a bunch of trailers, and thank you for dropping by, Jacob. I really appreciate it.
Anytime.
I'm joined now by Slash Film staff writer Ryan Scott.
Hey, everyone. How's it going?
Ryan, welcome back to this podcast. It's weird because you and I talk every week. We have a show on Pop Cultured at patreon.com/popcultured, but it's rare that you're on the Slash Film Weekly podcast these days. So welcome back.
Yeah, it's weird because you and I, this is like how you and I developed any sort of relationship originally, because I did this all the time. And then, yeah, now it's like a rare treat.
Well, we're here to talk about They Will Kill You, which is a new action movie, kind of a horror-esque, I guess.
It's action horror movie. I would say, yeah. Action horror is the way. It's more action than horror, but both, for sure.
Yeah. So Zazie Bates stars in this movie. She played what was her character's name in Deadpool 2? Do you remember? Was it Domino? Is that right?
Domino, yes.
Yes. So that might be where people know her from. I know her from Atlanta, the FX series primarily. But she's a really great actress, and she's been thrust into stardom here in terms of like action stardom, reminding me very much of like, I don't know, like Uma Thurman in Kill Bill or something, where it's just like, it's you with a sword kind of going through a bunch of people in the movie. So what did you think about her in action hero or heroine mode here?
I thought it was incredibly effective. The thing is, like with Domino, she wasn't the lead. Here, she gets to be the lead. And I think she's very much earned it and is very effective in that role. She's a lot of fun to watch. Like the movie's on her shoulders, and I think she carries it very well. I've seen a lot of people say that it's like, oh, we've seen this movie before. Oh, this. I don't know how much I agree with that, but I think that, like, to whatever degree it succeeds and to whatever degree it's enjoyable to anyone, it's enormously owed to her.
Yeah, I agree with the fact that she is like the person who you definitely come out of the movie going like, she was fun to watch. As for the movie overall, I'm not sure if I would say the same thing. I was not a big fan of this one, but what did you think about it?
I really liked it. I enjoyed it. I mean, full like transparency, I was kind of coming off of bronchitis when I went to go see this, and like all of my medicine wore off halfway through the screening, and I was like kind of in like a weird type of like hell. But I ended up still really enjoying it. And like, it's kind of up my alley. Like it scratches a lot of itches for things that I just enjoy. It's weird. It's a little funny with how gross it is. A lot of the stuff is very practical, which I like. It's not CGI'd to death. It's like when it's gory, it's like gleeful about it. I don't like gore that's like torturous. Like there's a scene involving an axe on fire that I won't spoil, but like any of the gore that comes out as a result is just fun. And so I think in that way it worked for me. Like it's not one of those things that like I don't think it's like profound, but I also don't think it's trying to be. And I think like meeting it on its terms, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, there is an element of class commentary that I feel like the movie is trying to make that I feel like it doesn't really land. It just kind of has this like, hey, rich people are bad kind of thing. And it's like, you know, there's like the character goes in to save her sister from this effectively like a hotel or like a high rise that is occupied by a demonic force, basically. And so she's kind of like fighting her way through the various floors of this hotel, not necessarily as clearly as in something like The Raid, but
yeah,
kind of structurally, maybe kind of sort of similar like that.
Yeah, The Raid, and Dread, anything like that. It's got a similar idea.
But there's also this kind of like class component to it where it's like Zazie Bates' character is kind of posing as like a house cleaner or like a cleaning woman or something. And so there's a lot of like highfalutin people in here played by people like Heather Graham and Tom Felton, and you know, all of these people have like very small roles in this film, but there is this, like, the movie kind of presents these two opposing forces as like, hey, aren't we making some sort of commentary about the class disparity in America? And it's like, not really. You're just kind of, you're just by pointing that out, there's, you kind of have to say more than just, hey, isn't this a thing, to be like successfully commenting on it, in my opinion?
Yeah, I have a bit of a different, I have a different view on it, which is, I think, like, talking about meeting the movie where it is, like, it definitely, I don't want to spoil anything, but talking to the director, there's definitely like an extra layer to what's going on, but it's also not as deep as all that. Like, the metaphor is sort of obvious once it's pointed out to you. And like, I think as far as the class war stuff goes, like, it's all on Front Street. Like, it's, you know, the poor versus the rich. And I think a lot of people bring their own stuff to that. And I don't know that, like, it's the movie's responsibility to like make a deeper commentary on it, especially when it's this type of movie, you know, where it's more designed to be entertaining, I think, than it is to be like, commentative. So I don't know. Yeah. I think, it's not every movie's responsibility to have something bigger to say. And so, you know, I kind of, there are ways to read things and maybe it can be that, but like, you know, it doesn't always have to be. So I hear you, but I also don't quite, I didn't come out of it feeling that way about it either. But
okay. All right. Well, multiple perspectives here. It's weird that this movie comes out so close to Ready or Not 2, because they're both movies about sisters in these kind of heightened environments where they have to like murder their way through these rich people type of scenarios. You know, it's just like so strange that both of these movies would come out literally within a couple of weeks of each other. So I thought that was worth commenting on. And it's also bizarre to me that I don't remember if you saw, or I don't know if we haven't really talked about this, but you talked about The Raid a second ago. I assume you've seen The Raid. It seems like it would be very much up your alley. Okay. So I don't know if you remember, but there's a scene in The Raid where one of the characters goes effectively into the walls, and there are people with like either knives or swords or something that are like seeking out the hero and stabbing swords through the walls, trying to get to him. And that imagery plays out in this movie and also in Scream 7, which just came out as well. So like, what is going on where all this imagery and these kind of like structures and themes are being recycled in like this very, very condensed period on the release calendar? Just a really weird coincidence.
That's a weird coincidence. But I, as someone who's seen a lot of movies of like the, you know, either horror or action, like, entertainment realm, like of this ilk, like this is my bread and butter, I don't know how many times I've seen someone like walking through a wall or a thin, and like where the knife or whatever is coming through the wall. Like I've seen that.
Is that a common thing? Like I think I was really introduced to that visual idea for the first time in The Raid, and I have not seen it very often. I think this and Scream 7 and The Raid are like some of the only times that I can remember it. You're saying it's much more common than that.
I've seen it enough to the point where if I see it, I don't think of it as something like that special. It's like one of those things where like if someone gets stabbed through a bed, it's like, okay, yeah, I've seen that in Friday the 13th, but I've also seen that, you know, so I don't know that I've seen it 100 times, but I've definitely seen it more than 3. You know, so okay. I will say the scene you're describing in Scream 7 and the scene in this, which I won't spoil too much for those who are just about to see these or whatever, like those ones are pretty similar. But it's not that setup altogether is not something that I've, you know, like I feel like even like back in the day, like Tom and Jerry cartoons, there was stuff like that. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't feel that. I'm not trying to be funny, but truly, like, yeah, that's, you know.
Yeah, fair enough. No, I'll have to go back and I've not watched Tom and Jerry in a long time, so I'll have to go back and check that. I think the tone was a little bit off in this movie. Like, I think this setup is very effective, and there's just something about the execution and like the tone that didn't quite work for me. And I think it's very much like your mileage may vary. And like, if you go in with low expectations, you'll probably have a lot more fun with this. I did appreciate Zissy Bates as like a physical performer who can hold the screen and like capture your attention and all of that. Patricia Arquette doing something a little bit different than what she's doing in Severance, which I appreciated, that she wasn't just like effectively recycling that character. She's got like an Irish accent this time around. So, I appreciated like the little differentiation that she's doing there. And this is like a fine movie for me anyway. Listening to you talk about it, Ryan, this is probably not going to be like among your favorite films of the year, but it sounds like you enjoyed it a lot more than I did.
Yeah, I very much enjoyed it. Like, if I had some friends over and they were like, what should we watch? And it was like on streaming, I'd be like, oh, you guys haven't seen that? Yeah, I would totally watch it again with some people. Like, it's not going to be among my favorites of the year or anything. I think what I don't like about a lot of modern discussion of almost anything is that if it doesn't fit into these like somewhat extreme boxes, it's almost hard. It's like easy to dismiss it. I really miss just being able to like talk about like a 7 out of 10 thing or, you know, with like joy or pleasure and have that be good or good enough. I don't know. So I feel like this is one of those movies that I want more movies like this. I just want more just good movies that I enjoy and doesn't have to be profound or the best or worst ever or whatever. And like can just be good. And if other people are looking to have a similar itch scratched, I really do think that this does a good job.
Yeah, I totally agree with that sentiment. I think just for you, this is a 7 out of 10. And for me, it's like a 3 out of 10 or something. So like
but it's all relative to what, like I talk about this. I was talking about this with some friends after seeing Ready or Not 2, where like there are certain things for the individual where like, if you just give me a like slasher movie where someone is in a kind of cool mask and they have like an axe or a knife and they're killing people in like a single location one by one, like, that's probably a 7 out of 10 for me, even if you, as long as you just don't fuck it up. Right. But that's my bread. That's my comfort place. Like you probably have something like that for you. Right. So like, it's all, you know, there it's for somebody. It's somebody's comfort thing is kind of
definitely.
What I would say. Yeah,
definitely. All right. Well, you had a chance to speak with several of the people behind the making of this movie. And you were telling me like how sick you were even doing these interviews. And I listened to the interviews and you don't sound sick at all. You sound like a true class act professional here. So you really managed to hide that very well. But
I was I can't emphasize enough to anyone listening to this. I was so unbelievably sick. I had a bunch of stuff to say. I texted Ben afterwards and I was like, I'm just not coming. I basically was like, I'm not coming to work after this. Like I was so sick.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go now to your conversation with Andy and Barbara Muschietti, who are the producers of this movie. Obviously Andy Muschietti is the director of the It movies. And this is one of the first big movies that they produced that they didn't direct. And you get into that with the interview with them.
Yeah.
So let's get right to that.
Guys, thank you so much for taking the time. I'm when I tell you, I'm actually like genuinely a fan and I like it was my favorite movie of 2017. So I've been like wanting to talk to you for a decade. So like, I'm so stoked.
Finally.
But that was you directed, you produced that. Like that was your move. But this is the first movie you're producing under your banner.
Yes.
As is my understanding. How, one, how does that feel? And two, how did this become the movie that like was your the first one in that capacity?
I mean, we have produced under our banner before, but I think this is the first time we produced somebody else.
Right, I guess that's what I'm getting at, right? Like,
And it's been such a joyous experience, and a big part of it is Kirill. Kirill has been, Kirill Sokolov, the writer and director of this film, has been a pleasure, and a young person with an incredible vision and the mind. He's a physicist. He's got the mind of a scientist, so he's incredibly good at communicating his vision. And you know, from the get-go, we read the script, we saw his first movie, Why Don't You Just Die, which is a jewel. And we met with him and, you know, yes, this is it. We're doing it.
Yeah. It was great. It was great. Crazy, you know. The script was crazy. We noticed immediately. We wanted to see this movie first. And cool. Very cool. And also there's like some sort of like a relief finding someone that can do that you suspect can do an extraordinary work, and he did it. We only like helped him like get there by basically paving the road a little bit, lubricating some processes, and just being there when he needed us.
Well, but like last night must be a huge relief then, right? Like you go, because like as he says, it's the first audience to see it, and then like reaction is what it is, and you're just like, do you just get to breathe a little bit then? Like
that's the other big relief. I mean, we always believe in this movie increasingly. You know, as the more we got to the finish line, we more excited. But of course, that there's a big leap in excitement when you finally show it to the audiences and they confirm what you thought it would work.
Yeah.
You know, because every piece. I mean, we did the other screenings. This is the first big screening.
Yeah, yeah.
Test screenings and so forth. And reactions were in the same moments, but what we experienced yesterday was so amplified and magnified, and people were so excited because most of them, they didn't know anything about it.
I went in, I didn't even see the trailer, and I just like, I try to dodge it if I can before, and then I go in, and I was like, oh, okay, this is what we're doing.
Yeah, so it's very rewarding to get that fresh, experience and remind you what the movie really is.
So everything always changes through development, of course, but you guys read the script and then now the movie exists. Do you recall what was the biggest change from when you saw what was on the page to what made it to the screen? Was there stuff that had to get axed? Was there something that had to get added? Was there were there any better or worse, were there any big changes along the way?
No, and also the truth is no.
The ending. We played a little bit with the ending.
It was slightly different, but this is the best version. What you see there. Kirill also is a manic storyboarder, and not only he has instincts, and he's like fueled by his like crazy ideas, and he's chaotic. He's also like very technical about storyboarding, and he showed me the whole story, the whole movie storyboarded before time, which is a testament to him being a scientist, a physicist, I guess, because he needs to like structure things. But also he has a beautiful chaotic lunatic mind, and that combination is explosive.
That's like what Ridley Scott does. He storyboards the whole thing, and it's like that's not bad.
A little
to be
too much.
Well, Andy used to.
Yeah, I got a little more relaxed over the years because I realized that that the best things in film happen by accident. And when I say this, I don't mean like just go unprepared. You go prepared, but knowing that there will be, that the elements that you're bringing together will produce a chemistry that is unseen and before. And of course, you can storyboard the whole movie, but I increasingly want to see what happens on the day, you know, with the actors there that are on the set for the first time, and I have my ideas. The storyboard is here, of course. I don't need to, like, draw it anymore, unless it's a very, you know, it's a specific and complex shot where people need to see what's going on. Of course, there's. I'm not going to talk about storyboarding. I was a storyboarder before before filmmaking, but I learned to let it go.
So they're going to kick me out of here somewhat shortly, but I do have to ask a little off talk. This is completely selfish on my part. You've talked a little bit about maybe doing a supercut of the first two It movies.
Yes.
I think last I read, you said that would require filming some stuff.
Yeah.
I'm a box office guy. You are the only horror franchise with only two movies that made more than $1 billion at the box office worldwide. Okay.
Slow clap for ourselves.
Right. But what prevents that from happening? Like, what I think Warner Brothers would back up the money truck and say, do it. Like, why? What?
We didn't have time to do it because we were involved in all kind of projects,
including the show.
Sure.
The Flash.
The show had, like, you know, a priority over the supercut. And we're in a moment now where we can definitely go to the studio and ask for support. But when is the question, you know? They can say, yeah, go for it. But now we are sort of committed, like happily committed to season two of Welcome to Derry. And there's other movie projects going around, but we're gonna do it.
Feels like a good time. Just like, we'll just put it out right around the same time as season two. Come on.
I know. We can do, like, kill the two birds with the same stone.
Yeah, why not? They're about to get ready to kick me out of here. But thank you guys so much. I love the movie.
Thank you.
Such a pleasure to meet you both.
Thank you.
And then let's go next to your conversation with Zazie Bates and Patricia Arquette. This was a fun little dynamic duo here, the hero and villain of this movie. Anything you want to say in terms of setup for this one?
No, I didn't have a lot of time, but they were both so fun and so great. And it's hard when you only get like 4 or 5 minutes with someone to know how it's going to go. But this was like, this went as good as you could expect something like that to go.
Right on. Okay, here is that conversation.
You both get bloody. You both do a lot of cool stuff. What was your favorite kill or like violent moment to be on? Like you can be the offender or the one getting hurt, but like, what was your favorite one in the movie, both of you?
I really liked doing the fire scene. I have a big firefight in the middle of the movie, and it just kind of it was just this wonderful experience of, it was like a lot of work going into it, a lot of preparation, me trying to get the fight as like second nature as possible, and then introducing all the technical elements of like fire safety, which was a lot, and then ultimately, you know, we had to shoot that so piecemeal because, like, every time somebody was lit on fire, eventually you just have to cut the camera in order to not, you know, in order to keep, like, save them. So that was, like, a really, to see that all cut together, I was like, wow, that looks cool. So that was nice.
I know this sounds weird, but the minute that she gets that screwdriver in her back
and
she kind of wedges it out with the shelf or whatever.
It's very satisfying.
No, it wasn't satisfying, but it was like, ow. You know?
It was so clever, though, the way that they...
Yeah, it was like, oh, man. So that one kind of really got me. I didn't do that much crazy stunt stuff like you, but I just did some wire work. Like, oh, well, I don't want to...
Yeah, no, it's
okay. I don't want to
spoil
or anything.
Sure.
Anyway.
So it looked like a lot of... I mean, obviously stunt doubles are involved and stuff. Did anyone any sustained actual injuries during filming?
I have a scar here. There's a final scene where in the final fight, there was like a knife... I was like being wedged into my shoulder, and we did it a few times without padding, just because it's like, it's always time. And so you're like, I'm fine. Da, da, da. And after a few takes, I was like, cut. I need something here. And this happens, but like, so I have a scar. I need to get some Mederma, but it's okay. That's my little memory.
Yeah. You get to take it with you.
Exactly. I'll always remember it. It's my tattoo.
So then, Patricia, I got to wrap up here, but where does becoming a pig demon monster rank in terms of your entire career as far as cool stuff you've gotten to do?
Yeah, it was pretty far out. It was funny. Actually, there was the scariest thing for me to shoot on this was there was an incantation that I made before I put it on my head, and I didn't like to say that. Mm-hmm. And even though I always pray that everyone's protected and that I'm protected, and I I know I'm playing the bad guy and I'm doing this as service for the hero who's good. Mm-hmm. You know, that I want them to be the winner. That's why I'm doing this, right? But still, this incantation I really didn't like to say, even though I know it's pretend and I know and all of that. And luckily got cut out because I really didn't want it to be voiced in the world.
Maybe
I
you manifested that. You like Thank maybe you, yes. you were Thank like, you don't put that.
Yeah, out I was there. Like, I really don't like to say this.
Well, they're kicking me out of here, but thank you both so much. I love the movie. Congratulations. Thank you. Have a good rest of your day.
And then finally, you had a little bit more time with Kirill Sokolov, the director of the movie, and I think co-writer as well. So let's go right now to that conversation.
I was there last night. First off, how are you feeling, man? I feel like it went incredibly well.
I overwhelmed. Too many emotions trying to like calm down and just process it all.
Yeah. So this is your first like big studio movie.
Yes.
So how, if you could just take me like really quickly through, how did this even come about? Like, how is it that your first big studio movie is with Warner Brothers, with the Muschietti's producing, with like this, you know, incredible cast? Like, how did this even happen?
Looking back, I don't know. Such a weird life twist. But I think because of Barbara and Andy in the first place, and Alex Litviak and I, we wrote the script, and we like walked and tried to sell it, and we found them amazing producers and people who believed in the story and just like saw my movies, believed in, like, and trusted me somehow. And yeah, and then they made everyone else also believe in these movies. And here we are, we have this, like, yep. But it's incredible. And I'm so grateful that they supported original movie,
yeah,
which is much harder to make right now, and so, like, wild and different movie. So, yeah.
So speaking of the originality of it, there, I don't want to spoil too much for people, but, like, it feels like a lot of things.
Oh, yeah.
And so I noticed, like, a little bit of Tim Burton at moments, a little bit of Tarantino at moments, but were there any specific directors or specific movies you were channeling while making this?
I mean, a lot. I tried to think about it that you, like, every scene, when I storyboard it and I develop it, I'm thinking about what kind of emotion I want to give audience. And starting from there, you just, like, okay, if it's... you kind of, this will be the right tone, this will be this right genre, and it can change inside of the scene. And then it's like, okay, I think it will work great if it work like a spaghetti western, and we'll have this classic standoff, and the editing of the scene will work like a spaghetti western, and like the Sergio Leone pace and music will have the reference. And then you go to the next scene and then you're saying like, okay, now we are on Sam Raimi territory, and it's like dark and horror and comedy together, and it's like, so it's just like I try to look at each scene and like just find the best way to give much as much as possible to the audience.
So there are lots of, I think the trailer makes no bones about the fact there's a lot of violence in the movie, and there's a
yes.
lot of, did you have a favorite kill? Even though a lot of, even though a lot of the kills are, you know, well, again, not spoiling anything, but like, so did you have a favorite one that you were able to pull
off? I mean, this is obviously, you know, a very big moment of the movie. Uh-huh. I think that one is special, especially how, like, funny and gore and over the top, but it's the same amazing, it like all looks and comes together.
Yeah, it looked great. So, and then as far as there, you talked a little bit beforehand that you were surprised at how many practical visual effects you were able to get in the movie.
Yeah.
And it really shows.
Yeah.
It's like there, yes, of course there's CGI, and but some of that stuff really looks real, and you see less of that these days. Did you have a favorite practical thing that you got into the movie where you were like, I'm so happy this is a real thing?
I mean, eyeball.
Eyeball
is a dummy. It's basically, we had three versions of it, different sizes, and it was a rod puppet. And we had Adrian, amazing puppeteer from prosthetic team. Yeah. He controlled it and rolled it, and it was a whole journey of working with that thing, and it was so exciting. And you know, other fun that people don't realize, you're making a big studio movie,
yeah,
and you have like a lot of grown-ups on a set trying their best to do a film, and they all like making this like small eyeball roll around and really care and look at the playback, hoping that it's all like comes together. It's exciting. It's very exciting.
Yeah, it looks so cool. So the other thing is like the hotel.
Yeah.
The hotel. So there's obviously the exterior shots. That had to be something.
Yeah.
But then there's also, how did you like, was that at least the outside, was that like a real location? Or then did you just build all of the different floors like on sound stages? Yeah. How did the hotel come together?
It's kind of combination of real location because we shot it, the whole production was in Cape Town. So we found streets, we found some place, but also we had to add on top. We built the first floor that we stitched to a real building, and we built our own doors and interior of Virgil. And then inside it's like all, because the movie is so action heavy, and this action includes like rain and water that floods everything, fire effects, snow, and all of this thing. It's what, and also because like the camera was so like so active, we needed to have the sets almost like a Lego, when we could just like remove one wall, open the hole, bring the camera here from the ceiling. So we decided, okay, we'll just build everything. And we were thinking about like the way how to build it, how to make it exciting for the audience to stay inside of the one building for 90 minutes. So that's where this like very specific and clear progression of how the environment changes with the character's journey. And it kind of represents Dante's Inferno. And like with each floor is like new circle of hell. And they basically, they go up, but actually they go down straight in the heart of the hell. And if you rewatch the movie with this idea, you actually recognize a lot of like symbols and elements and patterns that give you a small clue.
Awesome. So I don't have a whole lot more time, but I know like there is clearly an immense amount of pride that you got an original movie made at a studio, and it is very original. It is, but it also sort of like that first John Wick. It just feels like there is such a big world here. Have you kicked around any ideas of like, let's say this does well, is this truly a one and done thing for you, or do you see an opportunity for more stories in this universe?
I mean, I love those people. I lived in this world for 3 years now. I love the characters and I love actors who did these parts. I love people behind the camera, and I would be so, so happy to go back. And I think the universe is so rich. There is so many ways, and I have like extremely, I think, cool ideas how we can keep running, and like it could be like it could go in different directions. So let's see. Hopefully it will work.
Yeah, but you've at least put some thought into that idea. Like, you know, okay. Because to me, like, even there was like, because you sort of go through that photo book and you're like, oh, there's 100 years of history here.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's a lot to do. They're about to get, but honestly, truly more than anything, I just want to say I had such a great time. I loved
it.
Thank
you so much.
Whatever you do next, I can't wait to see you, man, because it's like, it was such a good time. So congratulations on everything, man. Thanks so much.
Okay. A few weeks ago, I had a chance to see a movie called Mike and Nick and Nick and Alice. It's about two gangsters played by Vince Vaughn and James Marsden, who are in a love triangle with the same woman played by Isaac Gonzalez. And the chaos that ensues when their unstable mob boss, played by Keith David, and his fail son, played by American Vandal breakout Jimmy Tatro, think that there is a rat in their organization. It also introduces a sci-fi component because, as the trailer reveals, Vince Vaughn plays two versions of his character, one from the present and one from the future, who comes back to prevent a tragedy from happening. This movie is a blast. The action is hard-hitting. The performances are all very strong, especially Vince Vaughn, who I don't think has been this good in at least the past 5 years. It's also really, really funny. It's full of what I will call millennial humor. And if you're around 40 years old like I am, the references and jokes have a pretty good chance of being right in your wheelhouse. The soundtrack is especially great, which is another thing that I think will work super well for people of a certain age. The movie premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival in the middle of March and then dropped on Hulu this past Friday. Unfortunately, it did not get a big theatrical release, which is a bummer because I would have loved to have grabbed a bunch of friends and gone and seen this in the theater. But that's the world we live in now. So anyway, I absolutely recommend checking this out and then coming back to hear the rest of this episode. A few weeks ago, I had a chance to speak with Ben David Grabinski, the writer-director of this movie. He's been a big voice on film Twitter and in cinephile circles for a long time, and he has a lot of friends who are journalists and podcasters and are in my corner of the industry. I had never met him before this conversation, and I could see why people really like talking to him, because he knows his stuff and he seems to really relish the opportunity to get to work in this business. Two quick things before we start. There might be a bit of background noise here. I tried to get rid of as much of it as I could, so apologies for that if some of it sneaks through. And then the other is that Ben David mentions something called a motion control rig, and I wanted to take a second to explain what that is for people who might not know. It's basically a piece of technology that allows for the camera to perfectly repeat the same camera move multiple times, which is very helpful when you're making a movie where the lead actor needs to play multiple characters who appear next to each other in the same shot, because you can film it once and then have them change clothes and film it again, and you can blend those two takes perfectly in post-production. So anyway, I think that's all the context you need for my conversation with Mike and Nick and Nick and Alice director Ben David Grabinski. I was on board with this from the second that I realized the opening song was Why Should I Worry from Oliver and Company. So why that song?
I have to tell you, one of the funniest moments of the entire making of this movie was in pre-production. I had to request two songs because they are used in the movie. Like, I planned about 90% of them, and then some of them changed later, but I had to, in advance, clear this song and Oasis way early. And the Oasis one, by the way, this is a post-release thing,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay, so the Oasis one, we cleared before they decided to have a reunion. I think if I hadn't been really prudent and tried to get it, I would have gotten a lot of trouble. But I requested this. And I remember vividly my line producer, Richard Middleton, who I love dearly, walking into my office in Winnipeg in pre-production and saying, "Are you aware you've requested a song from an animated dog picture?" And I said, "Yes, I'm aware that the song I chose is from Oliver and Company." And the scene itself, it amuses me on a lot of levels, because on the page, it was maybe a paragraph, and it didn't really seem like anything. And I really wanted Ben Schwartz for it, and I offered it to him. And he, the word I heard back was, he's interested, he really likes the script, but it sort of feels like it's not much of a scene. Because on the page, it's just, there's a scientist in his lab, he's working on some things. I only had one sentence. He's singing along under his breath to a song. And when there's a bright flash of light, a mysterious figure appears, he gets shot and dies. So it's like, you just want me to show up, sit at a computer and get shot and die. I'm like, so let me show you some storyboards. And we got on a Zoom, and my storyboard artist did like Fury Road and Furiosa, and he's like a genius. And I boarded every shot of it, and I had my concept art of the lab, and I walked him through the scene. And he's like, oh, so it's like a musical scene? I was like, exactly. my whole feeling about it was, I haven't seen a time travel movie open this way. I haven't seen, you know, the doc equivalent in a time travel movie kind of behave in this way. And why not have a big opening? It's one of those things where I didn't really tell anyone I was doing it except for Ben and my crew. And I remember a lot of people on set kind of realizing, wait, we're spending about 10 hours shooting Ben Schwartz singing Billy Joel song from Oliver and Company in these big sort of fancy shots. And I was like, yeah, man, this is the big opening of our movie. And I think in general, I just did want this to feel like a movie that every 5 or 8 minutes turned in a way that kept you on your toes, you know? Like, if you've never seen the trailer or don't even know the premise, it has to be even more loopy. You know, but that, I have to imagine most people don't expect the movie to open that way.
Yeah, definitely not. I mean, I grew up watching those Disney sing-along VHSs.
And me too.
Oliver and Company, like that song from that was like on there, and that was my favorite one as a kid. So I know that song super well from just hearing it over and over again. I've probably only seen Oliver and Company like a couple times in my life, but why did you choose that song? Why was it important for that to be the thing?
It just felt like something his character would be into. I also just really like the idea of a guy who is a really dumb, smart person because he borrowed money from the mob and Alice said, don't do it. And before he gets killed for the mistake, he's singing, why should I worry? Why should I care? Which is more of a second viewing kind of added thing to it.
Yeah.
I love the song. It felt like the right energy. And it has kind of an added ironic level of humor the second time. Just the what he's just so carefree.
Yeah.
And this is he's doomed because he shouldn't have borrowed money from the organization.
Man, that's great. Yeah, Ben Schwartz is he just always puts a huge smile on my face. So it started off really, really wonderfully. I was super impressed by the way that you're able to make two Vince Vaughns in the frame feel really natural. I thought those performances were very distinct and easy to track and everything looked super seamless. But was there ever a moment when you were filming the movie where you were kicking yourself as a writer for writing a scene a certain way where like maybe it was especially difficult to accomplish what you needed?
You know, it's actually the opposite of that. Is I felt like if there was a time when I was writing things to direct where part of my brain was thinking of the degree of difficulty of things, and with this, in every aspect, I turned that off, you know, in terms of combining genres, complicated tone stuff, stuff that's technically complicated, and also I've never directed a frame of action before. So it is almost designed to be as difficult as possible because the challenge of it felt worth it, you know? It felt like I should only be chasing what feels correct creatively, but because the emotional and thematic thing about it requires it to be one guy playing two people. And if I started thinking about how much of a pain in the ass it would be, it would get in the way of the movie. Mm-hmm. And it was, I remember so specifically the first couple meetings I had about motion control and prep, I needed to take a break after because I had a literal headache. I was like sitting on a Zoom with people because I'm a big prep guy and I'm a big, big believer in figuring everything out in advance because then you have freedom to change everything. But I needed to figure out how to do it. And the degree of difficulty of it was so much more complicated than I expected. You know, you really only should be doing it in a movie that's like a tentpole level budget. This is the best example I can give. There's a scene when the two Nicks are walking down the hallway to his apartment after they get out of the elevator. That requires like a giant motion control camera on a rig that is coming all the way back to the end of the hallway. And then you have to repeat it. But the issue is that's a gigantic set. And you have to find a soundstage big enough that the crane can fit outside of it that has the entire motion control rig on it. And you have to like figure out in a 3D map how much distance I need outside of the actual set within the soundstage to fit the crane in order to have just a walk and talk. It's like a simple thing of a guy walking down the hallway. And I'd have countless meetings about it. And then we went into a soundstage and taped everything up to see how it would go. And then we had two people walking and we had to figure out like the distance between the lens and the person to get the shot. And we had to build the entire set just to have that shot. And it's just two people talking. You know, it's not like it's one of the least complicated moments in the movie if it was two actors. But because like you couldn't do Steadicam because you can't like have a Steadicam rig repeat itself in motion control.
Right.
And, you know, I understand cinematography and production and how to do a lot of things, but I did not know how to do this. And so I had to figure out how to do all of it. And then you have to figure out how to do it with an actor where you're not impeding their process. Because Vince is a guy who's pretty loose, but you have to get things exacting when he's interacting with himself, because you can't mess with it. It's like, you know, we'll spend hours doing one side of Vince and hours doing the other side, and it has to, the A and B takes have to match. So that becomes its own challenge as well, where you don't want to get in the way of an actor doing what they do best by putting restraints on them. But there are. Anyway, this is a really long way to say that, yeah, it was a pain in the ass, but worth it.
Well, how did Vince react to the practicalities of what that actually looked like on the day? I imagine you can talk about it in prep or in early meetings with him or something, but then like actually being there and doing it, I don't think he's done anything quite like that before. So what was that like for him?
I mean, we did a test about a week out to sort of start to get him, you know, sort of start to get the hang of it. And then I designed it so the first few days of it didn't have a lot of moving camera stuff. So, you know, there's a learning curve because it's, you know, he's the most experienced actor on the planet. But it is a new thing. And, you know, it's the first time where, you know, because we had this actor who would be in the scene as the Nick. Like we would start, we have to decide which one we're starting with and then also discuss with him if he prefers to start with one. But then you end up with this whole math of, okay, well, this depends. This means this, we have this many costume changes and makeup changes to switch, which is a not interesting headache, but it exists. And, but it's something where like, I think he found very interesting, but at first we just all had to figure out, because he has to have like an earwig in his ear and hear what he did the previous time and work within it. And that's just a different thing than, you know, acting against a person and just reacting to them. You want your movie to not seem difficult. You want people to just enjoy it, but you shouldn't watch it and think that things are like how hard or easy it was to make a movie, but it all worked out and I'm excited about it. But you know, the first, I'd say like 40% of the process, including prep, was sort of just learning and doing a crash course and stuff. And unfortunately by the end, I feel like I really got the hang of it, but I don't think I'm going to do it again.
Yeah. One thing that I thought was unusual about the movie is that characters will often make a reference to something, but the person they're talking to will have no clue what is being referenced. And it's very funny, but those struck me as moments that maybe an executive might read in the script and be like, hey, can we like cut this? Can we get rid of this kind of thing? Did you have any pushback at all at any point of making this?
The interesting thing about this is, the reason I made it with 20th is they were the first people who read it and recognized that all of these things kind of add up to one thing. They didn't feel like, yeah, we like all of it, but do you really need the Gilmore Girls references? Or yeah, we like all of it, but do you need this thing? And that was very helpful because it's, you either sort of get it or you don't. Mm-hmm. And I understood that it would all work in context. And I just do think those things are very funny. And I was just lucky in the fact that the studio understood my point of view on the movie tonally, and the cast did too. But that's one of those weird runners where you're not really sure. Like I wrote all of them. The only one I made up on set was the Winnie the Pooh one. Because I was just really enjoying the chemistry between Jimmy and Keith. And I pitched him the Pooh Loves Honey thing. And then Keith, his response. And I was sort of finding it while we were shooting. But yeah, there is kind of just this weird runner of, there's, whenever someone is talking about a pop culture thing, they're talking to someone who doesn't know the thing. I don't know why, it just seemed funny, and it seemed funnier the more I did it. But I didn't know if people would sort of lock on to it. And then I remember at a test screening, like multiple people wrote down, like, you write your favorite funny scenes, and people would write something to the equivalent of, I really liked whenever someone would reference something and someone didn't know what it was. I'm like, okay. All right.
That's great. I'm just realizing that you said you learned all this stuff. You probably don't think you're ever going to put it into use again. Does that mean that you're not interested in making a sequel to this? Because, like, in the moment, I thought the final scene of this movie was just like a really good way to end a film. And then afterwards, I kept thinking about it. And I was like, you know what? I actually wouldn't be opposed with watching a sequel to this if you're interested in making one. So is that not something that you're really thinking about in a serious way?
Well, I don't think that way at all. Like, to me, it has to be self-contained. And I put everything into making the movie I wanted to make that did what I wanted it to do. And, I could wake up 6 months from now and have like an epiphany of what I want to do, but I didn't want to make a movie. I just sort of felt like if creatively I was thinking about a follow-up, it would undercut what happens. Like, I understand how someone could misunderstand the ending as maybe being a cliffhanger, but I think it's not. I think you see everything you need to see to know that somehow Mike is going to fix things,
Yeah.
and you don't need to see him fixing things or how he does. You just need to know that, like, Nick did a great thing for Mike, and now Mike's going to do a great thing for Nick. And that's kind of the emotional closure of the movie.
Totally. Yeah, it's more of just like a projection for me of being like, I really wouldn't mind spending more time with these characters because I enjoyed the experience so much, so.
I mean, if I woke up one day and had an idea I really liked, I could see something like that happening, but I kind of, I wasn't really thinking more than like a foot in front of my face this entire time.
Yeah, sounds
Like,
pretty
I wasn't even
complicated.
thinking like, will I make another movie? Like, will I make a sequel? It was just like, I like behaving as if everything is the last thing I get to make, and I just got to try to feel like I'm really stoked about it.
Yeah. All right. Well, I don't want to take up much more of your time. I just want to ask you one more question. When you have incredible character actors like Steven Root, who I know you've worked with before, or Keith David, who you alluded to, do you have time to ask them for stories about your favorite movies of theirs while you're working together?
Sir, what do you think? If there's anything anyone would probably guess about me, is that I'm not going to keep my enthusiasm to myself. I mean, I think one of the biggest benefits of becoming, a filmmaker or having some level of success is you can get away with being a big fan even more. Because like if a guy on the street walked up to Keith David and was like, "Hey, so I heard there's fight scenes with you that got deleted from Roadhouse. Can you tell me about that?" They'd be like, "What?" But if I do that on set, it just makes sense, and Steven Root and I have become friends. He's been in everything I made. He even does a voice of the Nanobots in the Scott Pilgrim show, which he just came
Amazing.
in and did for to make little gremlin noises in the finale. I wrote Chet for him, and part of it is just because he's such a good hang. I mean, I think he's one of the best actors in the world. And the voice of that character was clearly written for him. But it's also so I can say, "Hey, so when you said pan shot, what was that like?" I can text him about, "Hey, I just watched Ghost. What was it like being the detective in Ghost?" And Keith is, there's a thing I did in there for him, and he was genuinely touched. As I was talking about how much I like gargoyles, and he was saying his favorite line from that show was when someone got called street pizza. So I rewrote a line, and he got revised sides, and he walks up to me. He's like, "Am I going to say that Mike is going to be street pizza by morning?" And I was like, "Yeah," and he was like, "Yeah." It was just because we were sitting on set when we were shooting the club scene, and he was talking about how much he liked saying the phrase street pizza on that show. And so sometimes you benefit from having those discussions. But Keith has been in too many things that I love. I unfortunately spent a lot of time talking about Gilmore Girls just because I accidentally found out he was a huge fan of it. And I could have spent that time talking about Men at Work, but then I did already talk about Men at Work a little bit, so I think we're okay.
Definitely. All right, man. Well, thanks very much for your time today. I appreciate it. And congrats on the movie.
All right, thanks, man.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's episode. You can find more about some of the stories we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com. I'll link to a bunch of stuff in the show notes, as usual. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Check out patreon.com/popcultured to hear more from many of the folks that you heard on this episode. This week, Jacob, Brad, and I did a ranking of Jack Black performances, so check that out if you're interested. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. And hey, if you're still listening to this part of the episode, please do me a favor and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It's been a while since we've had a new batch of reviews, and that kind of thing helps drive the algorithm somehow. I'm not sure exactly what the inner workings of that are, but I know that getting attention like that on the review side of things helps kind of circulate the podcast into the algorithm a little bit, and maybe will help put us in front of new listeners, which is always helpful in terms of keeping this show alive. So I would really appreciate it if you haven't left us a review. Take a couple minutes and leave us one if you can. That would be a huge, huge help. And tell your friends about the show. I know I say that all the time, but if you have a friend who you always talk about movies or TV with and you enjoyed any of the conversations that you heard in this episode, please send this episode to them. That would be, again, a really big help just in keeping the show alive and lasting as long as possible, which is certainly something that I want. I want to keep this thing going as long as I can. And all of your help can assist us greatly in doing that. Okay, enough from me. Thank you so much for listening, everyone, and we'll talk to you next time.